Welcome to the Malefactors Register podcast. In this episode we present two true crime stories of men driven to kill by their desire to succeed in business. The first story, Murder in Three Acts, is the tale of George Edgley, a crooked Massachusetts businessman who used gun to take care of his problems. Our second feature, Stay Out of His Way, is the story of a Southern California pimp who discovered that murder makes for a bad business plan.
Murder in Three Acts. George Edgley has had more brushes with greatness than most career criminals. In 1960, with the help of F. Lee Bailey, Edgley beat a murder rap, and years later he was prosecuted by John Kerry for the 1975 rape of a Massachusetts prostitute. Bailey and Kerry both pulled a victory out of what appeared to be sure defeat, and in each case their performances helped thrust them into the limelight. But this isn't the story about Bailey or Kerry. It is the sordid tale of murder and mayhem that seemed to follow George Edgley throughout his life. Act 1, The Murder of Elizabeth Edgley. The story begins in December 1959, when Edgley's 25-year-old wife Elizabeth disappeared after a confrontation with her husband in Lowell, Massachusetts, across the river from their home in Draycut. The couple had a stormy relationship and Edgley reportedly had a wicked temper. On more than one occasion, Elizabeth was seen with bruises and cuts that she blamed on her husband, and several witnesses testified at his 1960 murder trial that Edgley and Elizabeth had been fighting the day she disappeared. Elizabeth's disappearance on December 27th was the climax of an escalating month-long fight between the husband and wife that began on Thanksgiving. That day several people heard Edgley tell his wife, "I'll kill you yet," when she asked him to go out and buy a loaf of bread. Edgley was irked because his brother-in-law and his wife were sharing Thanksgiving dinner despite the fact that Edgley was unemployed at the time. 2 weeks before Elizabeth vanished, Edgley's temper once again raised its head when Elizabeth, her brother, and another man were enjoying a few drinks at the Tremont Cafe. Edgley appeared and tried to pull Elizabeth out of the booth. Elizabeth's brother, Francis Hawkins, accompanied his sister out to Edgley's car, and when Edgley emerged from the tavern, he attempted to throttle Hawkins. The unidentified friend happened to have a handgun and Edgley reportedly tried to grab it from him. "He would have killed the three of us," Hawkins said on the stand. On December 27th, Hawkins, Elizabeth, and Edgley were drinking together at the Three Pines restaurant in Middleton, where they ate dinner. They next headed to an Allenhurst restaurant where they continued to drink. Hawkins was upset that his wife had become pregnant by another man, and the trio was discussing his options. After about 3 hours of drinking, the group left and headed back toward Draycut. Both Hawkins and the barmaid said that Elizabeth was so intoxicated when she left the bar she had to be physically helped to the car. Hawkins said she was unconscious when Edgley dropped him off at around 11:15. No one ever saw Elizabeth Edgley alive again. Hawkins and Edgley met up again about 5 hours later, and Hawkins noted that his brother-in-law had changed clothes. Hawkins asked about his sister and Edgley told him she had taken off at the corner of Pawtucket and School Streets in Lowell. "Betty won't be home tonight," Edgley told his brother-in-law. When Hawkins saw Edgley in the early morning hours of December 28th, he said Edgley was holding his right hand inside his coat and kept it there until he went into a shed behind his home where he remained for 3 or 4 minutes. Edgley did not report his wife missing because, according to him, it wasn't unusual for her to disappear for days at a time. After Elizabeth's mother contacted police, Edgley told them that he had stopped to aid a motorist stuck in the snow at the intersection of Pawtucket and School, and when he returned she had vanished. Edgley became a suspect in his wife's disappearance when he offered differing accounts of his actions after Elizabeth vanished and contradicted himself about what he was wearing that night. However, without a body, no outward signs of foul play, and a woman who was known to spend days away from home, the police had no case against him. Over the next several months, Edgerly was repeatedly questioned by police and, according to testimony at his murder trial, took more than 20 lie detector tests. It was not until April 11, 1960 that police were able to get the results they were seeking. "Now we have what we want," Lieutenant George Harnoy of the district attorney's office told Edgerly after that final test. "I think you killed her." Edgerly was nonplussed. "You have the right to your own opinion," he replied. Edgerly had been brought into headquarters for questioning that day because two young boys had found a dismembered female torso in a dry-cut brook. The head, arms, and legs were missing, but police surmised that it was the remains of Elizabeth. The autopsy revealed that the woman had been slain just a couple of hours after she had eaten, and that the killer had taken great pains to hide the woman's identity. The killer had used a hacksaw to dismember the corpse and then taken a knife to remove signs of a goiter. A search of Edgerly's shed revealed a package of 12 hacksaw blades with 4 missing. Police could not find a hacksaw, and Edgerly, an automobile mechanic, said he had lost his about a year before. Police also found evidence of bloody clothes in the trunk of Edgerly's car, which he explained away as the result of an assault on his wife before Christmas, when she was absent for a few days. About a week after the torso was found, a search of the area revealed the legs that belonged with the torso. Missing, however, was one foot, which police surmised was Janet's appendage that was malformed because of a previous injury. Edgerly went on trial in February 1960, and Bailey joined the defense team about halfway through the 17-day affair. George was an interesting guy, pretty unflappable. He was screwing both his mother-in-law and his wife's sisters. That was evidence in the trial, Bailey told Jeffrey Toobin in a 2004 New Yorker article on John Kerry. He was sitting in an iron cage in the middle of the courtroom, which is where defendants used to have to sit in those days. Bailey was called in to refute the polygraph testimony, and his masterful cross-examination and summing up were credited by many with helping Edgerly win an acquittal. "This is a case of circumstantial evidence," Bailey told jurors. "Nobody saw Edgerly murder his wife, and no one so testified. Circumstantial evidence is like a chain, and no chain is stronger than its weakest link." For their part, the prosecutors admitted that Hawkins was a convicted criminal who hated his brother-in-law, but that the jurors should not hold that against him. The state acknowledged that the case was circumstantial, but explained that this was to be expected. When a man intends to kill his wife, he does not invite the same people to the murder that he invited to the wedding, DA Frank Manarski told jurors. After 10 hours, the jury decided that the state had not overcome the burden of proof, and Edgerly was freed. Act 2, Motorgate. On February 1, 1974, a Beverly, Massachusetts resident spotted something washed up on the shore of the Danvers River. Investigating, he realized it was a corpse, and police were summoned. What began as a routine murder investigation would quietly become a national scandal involving the country's largest automobile manufacturer. Several people would go to jail for fraud and theft, and George Edgerly would end up on trial for murder once again. The victim, Francis Smith, was a Boston resident who was employed as a district service representative for General Motors' Chevrolet division. Police quickly recreated his last day alive, finding that he had spent his workday at the automobile dealership owned by R. Gordon Butler in Lowell. The last known people to see him that day were a Butler Chevy Service Department employee, James Lawson, and his boss, George Edgerly. It was Smith's job to monitor Butler's warranty repair jobs. The large dealership was expected to perform about $30,000 in monthly warranty work, but Butler was doing nearly twice that. While police in Middlesex County looked at the criminal side of things, auditors with General Motors began to examine the company's warranty program for possible fraud. The company will eventually uncover hundreds of thousands of dollars in padded warranty repair bills and large-scale violations of the company's ethics policy that forbids employees from accepting anything other than nominal gifts from dealerships. General Motors will maintain a tight lid on the extent of the problem, but after a 15-month internal investigation, about 36 employees in the company's Northeast offices were summarily terminated for violating company policies. About the same time that the employees were terminated, Butler Edgley and the dealership's general manager were indicted by a Boston grand jury for theft and fraud. Under the direction of that trio, repairmen for the dealership were submitting false claims to General Motors for warranty work. Customers would bring in their cars for simple repairs, which the mechanics would do, but GM was billed for extensive repair jobs like engine rebuilds and transmission work. GM not only paid for the repairs that were never done, but would also send replacement parts that were subsequently sold to other customers. When the press got wind of the story in those post-Watergate years, the scandal was quickly dubbed Motorgate. In 1976, Edgley was sentenced to 3 to 5 years in prison. Butler and his general manager, Theodore Chemos, were given 2 years in prison and fined $2,500 each. For Edgley, however, the conviction in that case was small potatoes. A month after Smith's body was found, Edgley had been indicted for his murder. Interlude, Edgley's rape trial. John Kerry was beginning his public service career as an assistant district attorney when he was tapped to serve as prosecutor in Edgley's 1977 rape case. It was not a very strong case against Edgley, despite the witnesses to the assault. The rape began on January 1, 1975 when Edgley and three other men picked up a young woman, a prostitute, at a Merrimack Street bar in Lowell and drove the woman to a wooded area where they forced her to perform oral sex. She also claimed that Edgley attempted to rape her, but was unable to complete the act. After the assault, the men drove their victim back to the bar. Kerry told me this Edgley was a lucky guy. This could be a snake bit case. It was not a slam dunk, one of Kerry's co-workers told Tubin in the New Yorker article. Nobody was going to try that case if you were looking just to put a notch in your belt. Edgley held the upper hand in the case, Kerry acknowledged. It was an improbable kind of case, Kerry told Tubin. The victim was very suspect because of her lifestyle and background. The bottom line was that she did not consent. The bottom line was that she had been raped. Raped or not, the victim had not helped her own case by trying to extort money from Edgley to make the case go away. She admitted on the stand that she was willing to accept money from Edgley, but said it was simply a ruse to get him to admit his guilt. The other men in the car, each of whom admitted he had lied in previous statements to investigators, testified that Edgley, 49, had sexually assaulted the woman and the jury convicted him of rape. For the first time in his life, Edgley was given serious jail time, 18 to 30 years. Act 3, The Murder of Frank Smith. The break in the Smith murder case came long before investigators in the Mothgate fraud case wrapped up their probe, and before Edgley faced off with John Kerry. A few weeks after Smith's body turned up in the marsh along the Danvers River, police were called to the local hospital where James Dolson, the Butler Chevy employee who spent the day with Edgley and Smith, was lying near death from a stab wound. He wanted to talk to authorities. Dolson told police that he had witnessed Edgley shoot Smith and dump his body in the Danvers River after a 12-hour booze fest. Over the course of their liquid lunch that stretched late into the night, Edgley was reportedly waving a pistol around and at one point asked Smith if he wanted to go for a ride. Dolson found his tongue after Edgley lured him to a remote cabin and stabbed him. Another man, Jackie Shanahan, was also present that day and turned state's evidence to avoid being charged himself. Edgley, already serving time for his role in Mothgate and for rape, was charged with assault against Dolson. At trial, He took the stand and said Shanahan stabbed Dolson because of some feud between the two men. Shanahan denied this, but Edgerly was acquitted. In 1978, Edgerly went on trial for Smith's murder. The evidence against him was once again circumstantial, but with Dolson's admission of seeing Edgerly shoot Smith, a man he had reason to want dead, this time it was Edgerly who faced an uphill battle to establish his innocence. At trial, the prosecution introduced witnesses who would testify that Edgerly asked them for a gun, saying there was someone he wanted to frighten, and Shanahan, who admitted getting the pistol for his friend. Shanahan also testified that Edgerly wanted to get rid of Dolson because he saw him kill someone. Edgerly took the stand in his own defense and blamed the killing on his old boss, Gordon Butler. Butler, Edgerly claimed, was involved in drug smuggling. On one trip to Mexico, Edgerly found that Dolson was carrying two aerosol bottles filled with drugs for Butler. Edgerly told the jury that he dumped out the drugs in an airport bathroom. Butler and his Mouthgate co-conspirator, Ted Chemos, began pressuring Edgerly for the drugs, claiming that they were connected with the Boston mob. Panicking, Edgerly told Chemos that Smith had taken the drugs. It was the mob that killed Smith, he said. The jury did not believe him. After trial, Edgerly was convicted of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison. Stay out of his way. People who got in the way of what Robert Leroy Beeler wanted often ended up dead. Sometimes people who simply crossed Beeler's path found themselves on the wrong end of a gun too. In the end, it appeared that Beeler, a pimp, thief, and murderer, only knew one way to solve his problems until society took it upon itself to solve the Beeler problem once and for all. At the end of 1966, Beeler was operating in the sordid underworld of Hollywood, California, consorting with hookers, madams, 8mm porn actresses and other lowlifes. He had been married in the early 1950s, arrested and convicted of robbery a few years later, sent to prison until 1960 when he was paroled and then sent back until 1966 for a parole violation. During that time his first wife divorced him, and after he was released in August 1966, Beeler married a woman named Janet. He lived with Janet and her two children from a previous marriage and worked as a painter. While he was in the joint, Beeler met and formed a relationship with Richard Dixie Aldrich, a professional burglar. Through Dixie, Beeler met a criminal defense attorney named Howard Myerson, whose clientele included Morton Malin, a 25-year-old gigolo and heroin addict who was living with a madam named Julia Cook. Julia lived in North Hollywood with her 15-year-old son Kenneth, and operated a string of call girls from her apartment. It was decent business for Julia, who reportedly took in between $500 and $1,000 each day. As a sideline, Julia sold 8mm porno loops and fenced stolen goods. Beeler had a sexual relationship with Julia, but he really coveted her trick book that listed her girls along with the Johns and their particular kinks. Although he was sleeping with Julia, his attitude toward her is evident from his statement he gave to police much later. "Her body was scarred," he remarked. "Her breasts were far too large for my taste, she didn't kiss as satisfactorily as I would have liked, and she didn't function very well." Beeler had plans to take over the pimping operations of the entire San Fernando Valley, and in order to do so, he felt he needed to get rid of Julia. To do that, he needed a gun. Fortunately, Dixie Aldrich knew how to get one. Attorney Myerson's bail bondsman had fenced a nickel-plated .32-caliber Breaktop Smith & Wesson from one of Myerson's clients. The Saturday Night Special found its way to Morton Malin, the gigolo living with Julia. Shortly before Julia was murdered, Janet Beeler overheard her husband talking to someone on the phone. "Can you get me a gun?" Beeler asked. It was Malin on the other end, and he agreed to provide Bela with the 32 for $150. The heroin junkie slash gigolo turned the gun over to Bela the next day at a bar called the Iron Horse. He recalled later that was loaded with 5 rounds. After the sale, Malin returned to the Myerson house, where he received a phone call from Julia telling him that Bob Bela had shown up at the North Hollywood apartment. When Julia called, Malin inferred that she was frightened and that Julia was muffling the phone like somebody might have been standing right next to her and she didn't want them to overhear what she was saying, he said. Malin waited until nearly midnight before he headed over to Julia's North Hollywood apartment. Inside he found Julia and Keen slumped in 2 chairs in the living room. The house had been ransacked and the TV was on. Julia's trick book was gone, and Malin, not wanting to pass up an opportunity, helped himself to some jewelry and $800 in cash. Malin returned to Myerson's home and said he had not been able to get into Julia's apartment. The next day Myerson and Dixie Aldrich convinced him to go back to the apartment to see if Julia was okay. Malin did so and reported what he saw. He told Myerson that he had seen the bodies in the same position the day before. Myerson called the police, who discovered that Julia and her son had been both shot twice in the head with a 32. A towel similar to the type that Bela's brother-in-law, a barber, used in his shop was found at the scene. Apparently the shooter used the towel to muffle the sound. Suspicion quickly centered on Malin, Bela and the Skells connected to Myerson and his law office. Bela convinced Janet to provide him with an alibi and he ditched the clothes he wore to the murder. Although the gun used to kill Julia and Ken was never found, Malin was arrested on suspicion and soon released. On the morning after the murders, Bela had called another friend and told her that Julia and her son had been snuffed. He told the friend to look in the Los Angeles Times, but the paper did not run anything that day. However, the woman did talk to police and based on Bela's big mouth, he was picked up and charged. When the police couldn't break Janet's alibi, the best the authorities could do was charge Bela with parole violations. He was sent back to the joint for that and the North Hollywood murder investigation went cold. In August 1973, Bela was re-paroled and was once again living with Janet and her children. They lived near Sunland, and Bela was trying to re-establish himself as a Southern California pimp. He passed his days at a bar called the Shadow Hills Lounge, where Janet had made friends with a young disabled Vietnam vet named Michael Cavani, who was supplementing his meager government stipend by selling cocaine. Bela and Cavani had a fatal run-in on October 14, 1973 in the parking lot of the Shadow Hills Lounge. According to the bartender, he was called outside at about 10 p.m. that night to see Cavani laying on the ground with Bela standing over him. Bela pulled the disabled vet, who had recently broken his left leg in a motorcycle accident, to his feet and dragged him to his car and away from the bar. He drove about a mile away to Janet's home, where she was sleeping with her 2 young children. An enraged Bela dragged the drunken Cavani out of the car, threw him on the front lawn and called for Janet to bring his sawed-off 30-caliber Enfield rifle. As Janet's 2 children huddled under the sheets of their bed, Cavani said, "Please don't kill me." Bela pointed the sawed-off rifle at the helpless disabled vet and pulled the trigger. Bela then ordered Janet to help him load the body into his Volkswagen. They threw in the rifle and a shovel and drove off toward the Los Angeles Crest Forest. Not far from a ranger station, Bela dug a shallow grave and dumped the body in it. He buried the rifle a short distance away. Bela then returned home, turned on a garden hose, and let it run through the car all night long. The next morning, he woke up Janet's children and had them clean up the mess. Cavani's murder had left blood all over the grass and sidewalk outside the daughter's bedroom window. Bela supervised their cleaning operation, explaining to Janet that Cavani had threatened to expose him to his parole officer for owning the firearm. He warned everyone not to say anything to the police. Unfortunately, Cabini's temporary resting place was not deep enough. A trip to check on things revealed that something had been digging at the grave, and Bina and Janet were forced to return to the site and rebury him. Moving the corpse ruined Bina's Volkswagen, and he was later forced to burn out the interior of the car with gasoline and dispose of the car. After this distraction from his attempts to launch another pimping operation, Bina returned to Hollywood and began handling some working girls through the Hollywood call board answering service under the name Carl Johnson. Bina and Janet fell out over his insistence that she welcome Christine Corder into their bed, and Bina moved in with Christine in early 1974. It was at the Hollywood call board answering service that Bina met Maida Sue Ellington, the office manager and bookkeeper, who also happened to be embezzling from her boss by taking cash payments and not recording them. Maida was involved with another woman, Carol Phillips, a former professional roller derby skater with a 5-year-old son. Carol went by the nickname Flip. Maida and Flip had a love-hate relationship that was trouble on a number of levels. Not only were they both women, but Maida was white and Flip was black. Maida was also dealing dope, working as a prostitute, and was stealing from her employer, none of which Flip thought was appropriate. When Flip threatened to tell Maida's mother that her daughter was a dope-dealing lesbian prostitute and a thief, Maida told Bina that she wanted Flip burnt. For $1,800, Bina was only too happy to oblige. Flip's contract killing, unfortunately, didn't go as smoothly as Bina's previous murders. Several days before Bina's first attempt on Flip's life, he and Christine went to a Hollywood costume shop and bought a grey wig and matching mustache. Bina then met up with Maida, who gave him a .22-caliber handgun to use in the hit. The plan was for Bina and Christine to pose as plumbers in order to gain entry into the house Flip and Maida shared. In an effort to be clever, Bina bought a toolbox, cut a hole in the bottom large enough to fit his hand and another in the side big enough for the barrel of the pistol. Then he wrapped the gun in a towel and tape. When he was satisfied that it was quiet enough, he and Christine headed for Flip's remote Kijil Canyon home. Maida had previously prepped Flip by explaining that a plumber was coming to fix a leak in the bathroom. On October 5, 1974, Imogene Pack and Nancy Moore, two school teachers who lived next door to Flip and Maida, were on the roof of their house fixing a TV antenna when two people drove up and parked in front of Flip's house. One of the men got out, wearing brand new blue coveralls and a grey wig and mustache that even from a distance appeared to the teachers to be fake. The man was carrying what appeared to them to be a tackle box. After taking a deep breath, he walked up to the house. A few moments later they heard voices come from Flip's house and then four banging noises. Bina came back to the car, handed the gun and a bloody glove to Christine, and they drove away. The school teachers could not get the license plate, but did manage to get a description of the car, a Volkswagen. Bina and Christine disposed of their clothes at her laundry and dumped the wigs and mustache in a garbage can somewhere along the way. She tried to run up the stairs, Bina told Christine. I knocked her down and told her to keep her mouth shut. This was a robbery. Bina told Christine that he shot Flip 4 times in the head and that he thought she was dead or dying when he left. The neighbors rushed over to Flip and found her lying in a puddle of blood. She had been hit 3 times in the head, twice behind the left ear and once behind the right. Amazingly, she was still alive and would recover from the attack. They called Maida, who met Flip and the police at the hospital and nearly brought the whole plot crashing down. Not knowing that Flip had told authorities that the shooter had identified himself as the plumber, Maida told police that they had had a plumbing problem, but that she hadn't yet called anyone to address it. The doctor who treated Flip vividly recalled later that Maida said, I am not surprised that this didn't kill her because she has such a hard head. In the weeks following Flip's attack, Maida did little to deflect suspicion. She told two co-workers that Flip was threatening to tell her mother about her lifestyle, and asked another if she would still like her, if she had flip-shot. On December 22nd, Bela and Maida decided to try again to kill Flip. The women were celebrating an anniversary at the Hialeah Lounge while Bela and Christine staked it out across the street. This time, they had decided it was going to look like a robbery. When the two women came out of the bar and got into their car, Bela got out of his Volkswagen and into the back seat of Maida's car. Holding a gun to Flip's head, he directed them to drive to a remote gravel road. Christine followed in the VW and watched as Maida got out of the car followed by Bela. He hit her with a blackjack, and Maida fell to the ground. When he walked back to the VW, Bela said to Christine, "This time she's really dead." Maida lay unconscious in the road for about 15 minutes until a couple who lived on the gravel road pulled up. They discovered Flip dead in the car and Maida with a bruise on her head and a broken nose. A search of Flip and Maida's home revealed two 22 caliber pistols, each similar to the one that apparently killed Flip. The ballistics tests were inconclusive, however. Because Maida had run her mouth so much before Flip's murder, police didn't take long to link her to the killings. She was arrested on January 30, 1975, the same day as Bela. None of the killings would have been linked if Christine hadn't jumped the row and went on a crime spree with an escaped federal prisoner named Michael Thompson. The two of them were arrested months later in San Mateo County, and Christine was good enough to lead police to Michael Covini's grave on December 10th. That led to Janet's arrest on the 11th and Bela's arrest the next day for Covini's killing and the murder of Julia and Ken Cook. California had no death penalty statutes at the time, so Robert Bela was convicted of four counts of first-degree murder and sentenced to life in prison without parole.
We hope you have enjoyed this edition of the Malefactors Register podcast. These true crime stories were written by Mark Gribben and read by Peter Gray. This episode was produced by Jeffrey Barnes, and certain musical selections were composed by Justin Ard Urban. I'm Rachel Johnson. For more true crime stories on the web, visit markgribben.com. This podcast is copyright 2011 and may not be rebroadcast without permission of the copyright holder. Until next time, goodbye.